As you may or may not know, at my request, Stephen and I have swapped. And whereas during most of this year, I preach in the morning and Stephen's preached in the evening, we have swapped around. And so the evenings on Sundays, hopefully, will be on the life of David. I won't attempt to summarise the last 23 sermons for you this evening. For those who aren't normally here in the mornings, you'll have to either grill me afterwards or listen to tapes or something. Probably a bit unfair on you, and I couldn't do it anyway. So, this evening, we're going to be thinking about a very important moment in the life of King David. And we read about it earlier in chapter 7 of 2 Samuel. There's much in the chapter to think about because it's such a significant point in David's life. It's the point at which David is given by God the promise of an everlasting kingdom through his son. A son who will never lose the love of God and whose kingdom will be established by God himself forever. David saw that promise as coming to life in Solomon. But beyond Solomon, there was the coming of God's great king, the Messiah, the Christ, the one whom we know to be Jesus. Well, in looking at this passage this evening, I want to start by concentrating on the circumstances which resulted in God speaking such great words to David. And then I want to think about the particular lesson that we see in this passage concerning God's ways. And then hopefully we'll end up with something that applies to ourselves. The events of chapter 7 take place at a point in David's life which is peaceful. We're told at the start of the chapter that the king was settled in his palace and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies around him. David now has his capital city, Jerusalem. He's already had a lifetime of battles, both before he was king and during the early years of his reign. Enemy after enemy, wave after wave has come up against him, but they've been defeated. And he's had his greatest victory. He's dislodged the tribe of the Jebusites from Jerusalem. For centuries they had mocked the Israelites that they couldn't be got rid of. But David took Jerusalem. The enemy in the midst was defeated. And there on that hillside, David built for himself a palace. A palace in his capital city of Jerusalem. And so you can picture David in that secure place, in a newly built and grand palace with strong borders. He's enjoying a period of rest. He was settled. He had been given rest by God. For a believer in God, a period of rest like that is a rare thing. It's rare because this is a world that's under God's judgment. And no true friend of God could ever really feel settled, at rest, here. A believer who feels completely settled and comfortable in this world must really wonder if they are a believer. Because this is a world which is at odds with God, which is fighting against God. This is a world that won't give to God the glory that's due to him. This is a world of sin and a world of trouble and a world of judgment which sin has brought in. A true believer can never know rest, peace, in a total sense, in a final sense here. A true believer will always feel that they're on a journey to some other place, to a better place, a place of promise. A real land of peace and harmony that the Bible speaks of. The new heavens and earth. But even if we're on that journey, there will still be, en route, places of rest. We read Psalm 23 at the start, and David there sings about the Lord as his shepherd, who brings him to green pastures. Places where he can lay down and eat. He takes him to still waters where he can drink and be refreshed. Now David says in that psalm, it doesn't mean all his enemies have vanished and gone, that all his troubles are over. David says that his enemies are still all around him in Psalm 23. But even so, he says, the Lord actually prepares a table for me in the midst of my enemies. David is able to sit and to eat and to rest, even whilst his enemies seem to be all around him. 2 Samuel 7, David has such a time. He's comfortable, he's secure in his palace, and the attacks of the enemies have subdued, and he's got time on his hands and quietness in his heart. His mind isn't having to be given over constantly to the next problem, to the next crisis. He can think of other things. So what David has here, what he describes in the psalm, occasionally God grants to us, we who are believers, times where you get that feeling of rest. Now such moments can bring either good or ill into the life of a Christian. You see, there is a danger in such times. And the danger is this, that we can confuse times of rest with times of laziness. Or that we can confuse times of peace with times of boredom. Later on, anybody who knows the story of David, later on you'll know that David falls into that trap. There in his life as an older man, David enters into adultery, a sinful liaison with a woman called Bathsheba. At that time, David was at rest. Or rather, he was hanging around the palace. But not because of any peace then that God had given him. But rather, he was lazing around. He was unwilling to go off and fight the wars that needed to be fought. And instead, he was looking for other things to fill his time. He stands on the roof of the palace. He watches pretty girls on the places below. He falls into adultery. It leads him into murder. At that time, David wasn't as he is here. This is not a rest granted by the Lord. At that time, David had just fallen into boredom and restlessness. He had a pent-up passion. It led him to do things he shouldn't have done. But even though we can misuse times of peace, even though we can misuse times when there aren't things pressing in on us, they don't all have to be like that. They can instead be very constructive times for a believer. And that was what it was like for David here. David was at peace from his enemies. He was feeling comfortable and secure in his new palace. So what does he do? It's not like later. He's not up on the roof with his binoculars. Instead, he is there turning his mind to good things. He is turning his mind towards God. Now, in particular, in David's mind is the Ark of God, which is now in Jerusalem. The story of its arrival is written down in chapter 6. But David's problem is this. He thinks of the ark and it's still in a tent. It's still under canvas. And that bothers him. He feels that there's a bad comparison going on. Here's David and he's in a palace and it's beautifully decorated. It's a cedar palace. And then God's ark, the golden box, the symbol of the presence of God, is camping out under the stars. And David feels that's wrong. He wants it to change. Do you see how David's using his time? He's not being frivolous. He's not being careless. He's using his time wisely. He's thinking of his God. And he's thinking of the honour of his God. He's saying, this doesn't seem right. I want God to be honoured in a way I don't think he is being. Let's think about this for a moment. Let's think about times of peace in a believer's life that God grants, just as we've read in the psalm, just as we've read of David. If you are a believer, let me ask you how you use times of peace in your life, the peaceful periods. Now, again, let me explain what I mean. I'm not thinking about spare time. I don't mean odd moments during days and weeks or whatever. There is a place for thinking about how we use all our time and using spare moments, how we spend our quiet moments. But what I mean is this. It's not those individual points, odd hours or whatever. It's those quieter periods of life. It's not necessarily where you have nothing to do. But those times of rest, when you feel that God has blessed you by quietening things down, where problems that you face at other times don't seem to be pushing against you at that moment. Now, I'm sure in one sense David had plenty still to do. There was, after all, a kingdom to run, a capital city to organise, an army to control, an economy to oversee. But still it could say he was settled, he was at rest. This was a time of peace. The big problems which troubled him had been calmed down for a while, and his mind was free to think thoughts of his God. Do you do the same with your quieter periods from God? We do have similar moments to this, don't we? I don't know what it will be for you. Maybe for you, it's that you've had an illness, let's say, and you've struggled with it physically, or you've struggled with it mentally, whatever sort of illness it might be. But finally, in God's goodness, it's been brought under control, or maybe it's even been cured, and you feel as though you've come out of a struggle and into a time of peace. Maybe it's been a period instead of your life of intense stress at work, some sort of pressure that's been on you to get something done. And you've been working away, and it's been day after day, and then it's come to an end. And you don't feel as hassled, you don't feel as troubled. It's not on your mind when you get home in the evening. Maybe for you that it's been that you've passed through a period of difficulties in a relationship, whether in your marriage, or with a friend, or with family, and you've been bumping around emotionally all over the place. And God's calmed it down. And God's brought peace into it. And you feel as though suddenly you've come out of a storm and you're cruising through calmer waters. Maybe for you it means that you've been facing opposition as a Christian. You've been every day at work or somewhere else, and there's been somebody who's just nagged away at you, mocking you, irritating you, getting under your skin about your faith. Or there's been somebody in the family, it's been your sister, and every time you see her, she digs at your religion. And then God quietens that persecutor. And you feel as though you've come again into a time where that's not troubling you, it's not bothering you, it's not going round in your head. Maybe it's just something as simple as a practical matter that's been dealt with. Maybe you've had builders in for the last 4 months and it's been a complete nightmare. And they finally hammered the last nail and put up the last piece of plaster and they've gone. And you feel as though peace has come back to the house. Whatever it may be in your life, it's that point at which you feel that life has calmed down. It's become quieter. You're feeling more rested. There's space in your thoughts. There's space in your feelings. Maybe you've got time you didn't have, energy you didn't seem to have. What fills that gap for you when it comes? David, surely, in this passage, gives us a good example of what should fill the gap. For a believer, surely, it must be thoughts of God. When God brings you into that moment, that period of peace, whatever it may be, why not say to yourself, first of all, and now I'm going to think about my God. Just as David was thinking about God's honour, just as David was pondering, what was necessary for God's glory, so you can think on your God too. How do you do it? Well, God has spoken. He said many great things in the Bible. You read them for yourself, maybe. You hear them read. You hear them preached. But when you read, or when you hear the Bible read, or when you hear the Bible preached, how often do you really get a chance to run over and over those thoughts? To go over, to chew them over in your mind, to meditate on them, to turn them into real understanding, to turn them into real praise, to turn them into real prayer? So often, we're crowded in, aren't we? We're not at rest, we're not at peace. So many things to move on to, so many things to do. If God then gives you a time where you do feel at peace, isn't that the very time to make full use? If you're there and you feel that you've this week stretches before you and you've just sat down for the evening and this feels like a peaceful week, you feel as though God has just calmed the storm and there's peaceful waters ahead for a few days, before you stretch out your hand to that newspaper, before you reach for that CD remote control to turn on the favourite song again, spend time first with God. Because that's why he's given you that peaceful moment. Let's think about this in terms of the time we're currently coming into. It's Christmas. You are going to hear a sermon about the Son of God coming into the world as a man. We all know that will happen, one way or another. What a tremendous, astonishing truth that is. And during this Christmas, you'll have listened to the various elements of the familiar story brought out all over again. You'll hear how the angels reacted, you'll hear about the shepherds, you'll hear about Herod, you'll listen to Mary's song again, you'll listen to Zechariah's song. Maybe you'll hear Isaiah's amazing prophecy about the coming of Emmanuel, God with us. But Christmas is a busy time. And these things will pass in one ear and they will pass out of the other. And the astonishing truth of the incarnation will have gone. Maybe when you're sat there listening, at some point it strikes a chord. Maybe at moments you'll get a bit of nostalgia because it's Christmas. At other moments you'll be indifferent to it. But soon, because of the way Christmas works, all of these things will have gone by and you'll be moving on. Well, if in the new year, as that new year dawns, God suddenly gives to you a peaceful week. Not a week without activity, you're still at work, you're still at school, you're still at home, whatever it may be. But if God gives to you a week where all the intensity has come to an end, and suddenly there's time and there's rest in your heart and mind, why not go back over the things of Christmas? Why not meditate on the incarnation, on the coming of the Son of God? The fact is that hardly any of us during Christmas will really take in what it meant for Jesus to be born. So if God gives you that peaceful week in the new year, why not bring out the Christmas thoughts again, even as the decorations go away? Why not go back over what you've been hearing? Why not run over the carols you've been singing? Why not think about the passages of the Bible you've been reading? Why not remind yourself of what the preacher said? When we're granted that moment of peace, that period of peace, turn your thoughts towards God and his glory. Rather than saying, phew, that's all over with now, where's the new novel I got? Why not first take time for your God? And as you run through those things in your mind, talk to God about them. Give praise to him. Give thanks to him. Rejoice before him that he should send his Son into the world for us, for sinners. If it helps, Why not write a letter to God? You write letters or emails, don't you, to thank family members because they sent you presents. Well, is God any less worthy that you should write to him? Is God any less worthy that you should sit down and actually take time to structure out and to plan out what you want to say to him and to think about the gift he's given? We say that the greatest gift of all at Christmas is the gift of the Son of God, born in Bethlehem. So why don't you write and thank God? Okay, afterwards you're going to put the letter through the shredder because you don't want anybody to ever see it again. That's fine. It's secret to your own heart. But you see what I'm saying? If you've got a time of peace, do whatever you can to concentrate upon your God and see that relationship with him built up. And it may well be then, like David, you'll feel there's something particular you should do. Just as David became concerned for the ark, maybe over Christmas, let's say, you received a nice letter from a non-Christian auntie. And she's very friendly and you're going to write back and you're going to thank her for her card and her letter. Bring into your reply some of the things you're thinking about. I don't mean that in a contrived way. You're not writing the poor lady a tract. You're writing her a letter as a nephew or a niece. But Christmas for you meant the coming of the Son of God. Christmas for you meant the worshipping of Jesus Christ, the Lord and Saviour. Christmas for you meant Emmanuel. So as you pen your letter back to that auntie, give glory to God within it. Finding himself at peace, David allowed his mind not to drift off into trivia, but to be concerned with the glory and the honour of the God whom he loved. And it led him into activity. It led him into something he wanted to do for his God. Now, having thought about that, David then wisely went and sought spiritual advice. He spoke to Nathan, who was a prophet in David's royal circle. And Nathan gave him advice. He told the king that what he wanted to do was right, and he should go off and confidently go ahead with his plan. And Nathan got it wrong. Prophets, preachers, good Christian friends get their advice wrong when they speak from their own opinions rather than what God has said. And Nathan got it wrong. And so that night God set him on the right track, and we have God's answer to David up to verse 17. What do we see in God's response to David's concern? Well, in his reply, God speaks about his ways. And it's that we need to think about next. You see, David's thoughts and Nathan's comments had gone astray. David was right to be thinking about God and his glory. But God needed to rebalance David to make him understand the way he should see things. The problem was that David had been applying his own desires to God. David feels that God's honour's suffering because the ark doesn't have a palace like his palace. And David is thinking to himself, well, that must matter to God because it matters to me. And God has to come to David and say, David, you're not understanding. You're not seeing what I see as important. As God reminds David, he's been living in a tent for hundreds of years. And he's never demanded that any of the rulers of Israel should be putting up permanent decorated buildings for him. In fact, throughout the whole of his reply, God plays down the significance of some sort of physical structure. And what he emphasizes is his relationship with his people and what he does for his people. You see this whole playing down in the fact that in the course of the whole 12 verses, from verse 5 to verse 16, God says just once something about David's desire. David wants to put up a house for God's ark. And God finally gets around to mentioning it in verse 13. He is the one who will build a house for my name. And yet when you read the whole thing, even that comes across as an ambiguous statement. God says nothing about it being a temple, nothing about where it will be built. And throughout the surrounding verses, he's constantly using a house to mean not a physical palace, but David's royal family line. So if you didn't know the subsequent history of Solomon, you'd wonder, well, does God mean a house like David's house? A family of people who will bear God's name? God is shifting David's thoughts. David has been right to meditate on the glory of God, of what he can do for God. But he needs to get those thoughts in line with God's own thoughts. Otherwise he'll be led astray. And in fact he needs to turn his thoughts around. You see, what comes out is this, throughout these verses. The lesson of these verses is that God's great concern is not what his people will do for him, but rather what he will do for his people. Let's just see how he does this. He turns to David in verse 8 and he reminds him where he came from. He says to him that you were following the flock. David was a shepherd boy. He was the youngest son in a large family and he tended to be overlooked. When Samuel the priest turned up, sent by God to find the next king of Israel, David's left out in the field with the sheep and no one thinks about him until God calls him in. It was God who raised David up to his high status. And God emphasizes to David that in all the troubles that have dogged him since, it's God who's carried him through, it's God who's cared for him. His enemies have been defeated, but that's not to be thought of as David's victories. It's God's victories. It's been God's handiwork. Verse 9, I have been with you wherever you have gone, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. And now, says God, your fame's going to grow. You're going to be known down through the history of the world. People will still be talking about David thousands of years after he's alive. They'll be talking about David in countries halfway around the world from where he lives. And why? Says God, because I will make your name great, like the names of the greatest men of the earth. And the people over whom David rules, they're going to be living in a kingdom of peace and security. But why is it going to happen? Is it because David's a great politician and a great soldier and a great leader and he's going to achieve it all? No, says God, it's because of my power. It's because of my plans. It's because of what I'm going to do. He says, I will provide a place for my people Israel and will plant them so they can have a home of their own and no longer be disturbed. You see, God's concerned about his people's home, not a house for himself. God is shifting David's thoughts around. He's getting David to think again. The great concern of God is not what his people do for him, but what he does for his people. God is not sat on the throne of heaven worrying about whether the great building project in Jerusalem is going to start up. Rather, the God of the universe, with all that might occupy his mind, is thinking about what he's going to do for David, what he's going to do for the Israelites. Whether you are a Christian or not this evening, your first need is to know what God has done, not what you might do for God. If you think that God is only interested in you because of what you'll do for him, then you've fallen into a bad mistake. God makes his plans because of who he is, not because of who you are. Let's think of it this way. In our relationship with God, it is not as though that he is one party in a negotiated peace process with you on the other side. It's not a case of each side giving a little of this and a little of that until you reach agreement and you and God can be friends. You know, at the moment in the news is all this discussion about the Northern Ireland peace process, and we're told how delicate the negotiations are, how one side has conceded one thing but then makes a demand from the other side. So Sinn Féin and the IRA want to have political power in Ulster, And so they say, we're willing to give up our weapons, but we won't show you any pictures of it, because that'll be humiliating. And the unionists say, we're prepared to have discussions with them, but we need the pictures to prove the weapons have been destroyed and to show in public the IRA are disarming. Each side making concessions, each side making demands in a tense negotiation which is on a knife edge. And it may go somewhere and it may go nowhere. We aren't in a peace process with God. There's no bargaining. It isn't the case that the gap and the hostilities between heaven and earth can be dealt with by a bit of discussion, and we'll agree to do this for God, and then God will agree to do that for us. The peace process between heaven and earth is all in one direction. It comes from God, it's done by God. We are creatures, God is God. And if peace will come, it will only come because God is willing to make peace with us. Ungrateful rebels who can do nothing to turn from our sins, nothing to make up for our sins. There is nothing you can do to make God love you. If God loves you, it is simply because of who God is, not because of who you are. And so the only question that really matters is this. Is God willing to love like that? Will the God who made the universe love sinful creatures? Is God willing to make peace with sinners? And the answer that's shouted out by the Bible is yes. God has looked down on the little creatures who have ignored him and who have mocked him and who have despised him and who have hated him. God has looked down on little creatures going their own way and rejecting the ways that their maker planned for them. God has looked down on them and he has loved them because of who he is, not because of who we are. If you know the history of Israel at all, you'll see just this being displayed in these verses. Verse 10 says this, I will provide a place for my people Israel and will plant them so they can have a home of their own and no longer be disturbed. What were the Israelites like? Hundreds of years earlier, the Israelites had been slaves in Egypt. They had been treated brutally. They had been treated unfairly. And God had mercy on them. He'd chosen them as his people. He'd set them free from their slave masters. And when they were set free, how did the Israelites react to God? Did they just pour out gratitude? No, they travelled across the desert to their promised land of freedom, moaning and griping and constantly threatening to go back to Egypt. And then God brings them into Canaan, their own land. And were the Israelites so grateful that they just said, and now we devote ourselves to God only? No, instead they decide it's much more pleasant to get together with the local population and indulge in a few other gods as well. And then later God raises up godly leaders and he gives them a man like Samuel to show them the right way to live. And are they then grateful and desperate to do all they can for God? No, they moan and gripe about it's not good enough and they need a king like all the other countries do. That was the history of the Israelites. They were constantly turning away from God. And yet despite all of that character, here is God saying that he's going to give to his people a peaceful home. He's going to establish a kingdom for David forever. Now in the end, that would not just be limited to the Israelites. After God had given the Jews every opportunity, even sending his own son to speak to them, still they threw it all back in God's face. And then those blessings from God went out across the whole world to reach peoples from every nation. But I hope you see my main point, and it's this, that as we read these blessings, as we read what God's going to do, and then we think about the people he's talking to, we say this is no negotiated peace deal between two sides. This is God just pouring out undeserved kindness, undeserved mercy, undeserved love upon people he's chosen to bless. The good news of the Bible is all about what God has done for sinful, rebellious people. It's all about God showing mercy, God showing love. If you sit here not as a Christian, you mustn't go to God expecting to cut a deal. You don't go to God looking for him to accept you because now you're trying harder. God has done what is needed to be done. And if you want to be one of his people, if you want to be saved, then you go to God not telling him what you've done or what you will do for him. You go to God and say, "Oh God, show me this mercy that you have poured out upon the world through your Son Jesus Christ. I can do nothing, oh God, save me." And even those of us who sit here as Christians must watch we don't fall into this way of thinking. God's attitude towards us is not dependent upon us hitting a mark. It's about God's unconditional mercy and love shown to us. We don't do things for God to keep him on our side. We do things for God to give praise and glory to him because he's brought us onto his side. Now, earlier on I spoke about the good use of our peaceful times. And I said how we can use those times to think about God and what he's done. I said that maybe in the light of that there's something we'll want to do for God. But we don't then slip into a misunderstanding and get things round the wrong way. We don't then think that it's making sure we get those things done that keeps God's love and keeps God's presence near to us. We aren't forever having to think up new ways to keep God sweet. We have the presence and the love of God because of God's own heart poured out towards us. So as believers, let's live the right way round. Don't start from the point of doing Christian things, doing things for God in the hope that those things will draw you nearer to God by themselves. That God will look down and see how well you're doing and feel warmer towards you and your Christian life will pick up. Start from the point rather where you say to yourself, first I begin with what God has done. I want to know what God has done. I want to think more about God and what he has said, what he has promised, what he has told me as one of his people that he has done for me. Learn about God. Set yourself to know more about God and his love for you. But then expect that discovery of your God will lead you to do more for him. Surely that must be the effect of anyone who is seriously learning about God. David heard God telling him about how he was going to raise up his son to follow him as king, and it'll be that son who'll build a house for him. David's son would know God as his father, be disciplined by him, have his everlasting love. Now, do you imagine that David's response will be then, "Oh, well, if God doesn't want me to do anything, then, well, I might as well get on and live life my way, because it's going to be the next one that God's going to be interested in. It's all in God's hands, after all." No, of course not. David's response we have. And he's thrilled by God's promises to him. Somebody who has learnt of God and is thrilled by God will not want to just go off and live for themselves. Somebody who has understood what God has done for him or her will want to live for that God, even if it means shelving their own plans, like David had to. As Christians, we must live this way. We must learn more of God. We must be excited by our God. And from that, we must desire great things for him. And if he blocks the way and doesn't let you achieve all that you desire, well, don't resent it. There are things that God has told us to do, then do them. There are things that God has told us not to do, don't do them. And there are many things he's not told us either way, like he never told David to build a temple. But learn more of your God and do what you can for him because of that, because you're so thrilled with this God you have learnt of and all he has done for you. Let's not build our Christian lives on what we do for God, is what it comes down to in the end. Let's build our Christian lives on our God himself. Let's find our joy and our happiness in him. Let's find our thrill and excitement in what he has done. Let's delight in our God. And then may that cause our lives to really glorify him.